totally. At the end of the last tape, we were discussing the various equipment that is used in modeling automobiles and clay modeling and plaster work and fiberglass work. And you had described the type of precision equipment manufactured by the Norton Equipment Corporation. And today, you suggested, and I think it's a good, it would be a good thing to have you give us a detailed audio description of the basic tools of the modeling trade, and perhaps describe them, and give us their precise usage in clay modeling.
I'll flick it off. Well, just a few words more about Fred Norton.
Yes.
He was on the east side, and during the war, when Ford Expressway was built through town, through Detroit, his building was right in the way of the expressway. So he moved out and moved the plant down to Blissfield, which is a nice farming community down, well, between Toledo and Adrian, I guess. So he set up what he did. He bought a what had been a local electric plant. And by that time, electricity was being bought from, I suppose, Toledo Edison. And so it was very stably constructed, this building, and made an excellent place to put in his machining tools. But what he did, what was different about his equipment and made it particularly suitable for clay modeling and clay modelers' use, there was nothing new about the use of angles and cubes and this sort of thing in machine shop work, except that those were always made of cast iron and extremely heavy, difficult to move about. Of course, you're working on a casting of some kind, and you need to scribe some lines on it. You don't want the angle to jump around. You want it to stay still. So the use of cast iron in making those angles and so forth were advantageous. But a clay modeler, he wants a quick line, and he doesn't want to have to drag something around that weighs, that he has to have somebody else help him move. So Fred Norton, along with a casting company up in Bay City, developed magnesium cast tools, aluminum and magnesium. And of course, the magnesium is what, half the weight of aluminum. Aluminum is half the weight of steel, something like this. So the use of the magnesium angles were terrific for the modeler. And of course, you can get these finished in various types of and degree of finish for accuracy and also for usefulness. In other words, they will put steel runners on the bottom so that the magnesium doesn't wear, and you have the accuracy of the steel surface on your surface plate. They also have machined in on these angles, the smaller ones, I'm thinking about, although also the larger ones, but they have a slot machined in and an adjustable platform so that you can use it to set up to a job and adjust the platform to whatever height you wish, and use a surface gauge or scales or whatever to take measurements from. So it's very useful tools, and it's something that's not going to go out of use.
Mm-hmm. Applicable to many disciplines.
Yes.
Especially apropos to this particular technique of clay modeling.
Yes, and particularly the lightweight. The thing that is taken place here in the last 10 years or so has been the switch to metric system by many companies. So the Fred Norton Company is, Norton Equipment Company has been very busy selling and refinishing some of the older tools that are out to metric dimensions. So it gave them a whole new start at this point. But
you say he was in the right place at the right time, right after World War II?
Yes, and he recognized the need, and I suppose he recognized the need because people were clamoring for these things. And I got to know Fred Norton quite well, and he was quite interested in people and people's problems and developing the equipment that people needed. And he set up a quite a nice machine shop, and he did a lot of his work with older equipment. But it's like anything else. You take a good machinist, why, he can get good work out of an old piece of equipment.
Is the Norton Company pretty much the primary supplier in this area to
That's correct.
Automobile design shops?
The suppliers of automotive design materials and equipment are rather few numbered, really. It's a specialized art form. And there aren't a whole lot of companies that provide the essential tools.
Does he provide the actual bridge as well that Ford uses?
No, he's never made a bridge. The bridges that Ford have, of course, the earlier ones were built right in design, as far as I know. They built them there.
Mm-hmm.
And the next set, the 12 that they have in the main studios now were built at the time that new styling building was constructed, which was in the early 50s. And they were installed perhaps in 53, 54, maybe 54, 55. It took quite a while to build them all. And those were built by Progressive Industries. I believe that's right.
A local firm?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then they had, and those are built and run on rails, on wheels on rails that are attached to surface plates that are mounted on columns from the basement of the building, the lower floor. So the surface plates are standing free from the lower floor on columns. And then they got a series of portable bridges built also by Progressive. And they're called portable because they can be moved and set up anywhere. And they have rails. It's similar really to the old original bridge design, and the rails can be moved and set up any place. So they have, I think, maybe a dozen or so of those. The thing that is happening now, which I mentioned a little earlier, is the fact that it is possible through utilization of data to mill lines or develop surface cutter paths, cutting paths. It's possible to mill a clay model. Now, this doesn't take the place of the modeler, but it does provide a means to perhaps start a model. In other words, those fixed areas, such as a glass area, which usually is fixed, and which may change during a program, but nevertheless, it's developed, and a modeler, if he's going to model it, why, he takes the points and templates or sweeps and sets that information in and cleans it up. So he more or less starts with that surface area. But you may have certain areas that are also fixed on an all-new program, such as the rocker panel or a tentative roof height and roof surface, certain things that they need to keep the areas like at the hinges. Some of this information is usually available. Or if you have scanned a model, or if you're utilizing some existing surface from another model or from a previous production vehicle, that surface information is known, of course, and you'd have data from that. So you can mill that in either lines. If you have the lines milled in, it's like setting templates. Same thing as setting templates, except that they're quite exact. So the machine will mill in the line, and then the modeler merely cleans down the surface with his tools to those lines. And this can be quite exact. What the modeler does after the surface or lines have been milled in, he dusts the surface with talcum powder. And the talcum powder goes down into the deep cuts. And then as the modeler works the clay off, the deep cuts remain. So you can finish a model and actually still see the lines that were cut in by the machine when you're all finished. You know, they're just faintly there. Mm-hmm. So you know that the model is within 2/3000ths of being right on. The types of tools, however, that are normally used, well, I have these cutters, and we can talk about them briefly right now. The cutter that is used for cutting lines is a point cutter, and it's a single spiral, and it comes to a cone tip and has some special handwork on it so that the even at the tip, the cutting edge will cut a curl of clay. Mm-hmm. The surface cutter is in essence a ball cutter, and so if you run it into clay and not move it along the surface and pull it out, well, you'll see that it's cutting a circle or a sphere, half sphere. Therefore, when the surface cutter, if you generate a surface path, a milling path for a surface, you would cut a series of these ball cutter grooves, just like when you mill iron for making dies, basically the same thing. Of course, when you're finished with this, you have a series of cuffs, little raised areas from one cut to the next, so those have to be cleaned off, of course, by the modeler. But the advantage of the ball cutter is that you can cut a very exact surface, but it takes a long time. The advantage of the point cutter is that you can set a series of templates and be very exact with it, and then the modeler can clean down in between those template cuts or line cuts.
Saves a lot of time, doesn't it?
Saves a tremendous amount of time.
Sets up precise coordinates for you.
That's correct. The types of tools that a modeler uses are, well, a variety of so-called wire tools, for one thing. You can have round ends. You can have shaped round ends.
Now, can you give us an illustration of what those would do?
Well, cutting clay for a smaller model or a special area of a model where you want to have some pretty fine control over it, you'd probably use a wire cutter and a small tooth scraper such as this one.
Now,
this,
like a razor blade.
Yes, some people even use razor blades. This
is
one,
for precise detail work?
It's for smaller areas, for finish work. This one, however, is a V-shaped blade. It's flat on the inside, it has the V to the outside, and one side has teeth, the other side is plain. This wire cutter is a wire of approximately, I suppose, 3/32, and it has the flat on the outside, the V on the inside, these three wires. This one is just a plain loop. This one has a loop with a tighter corner and a larger corner.
What type of detailed areas would be familiar?
Well, where you would want to get in and clear out an area, mm-hmm. you would use these. You don't use these for any finish work. You could use this one for some finish work.
If you're really clearing out a depression.
Right, that's correct. Then you have groove cutters. This one is 1/4 inch, this is 1/8 inch, I believe, for like cutting door openings,
mm-hmm.
or cutting where you need a groove cut in for various textures or this sort of thing.
This is for working on full-size clays or scale models.
Yeah, it could be either. Then you'll have wood tools, hand tools, which really are derived initially from normal sculpting tools with soft clay. So they're very similar, and for similar work, using it with smaller detail work on a model.
Seems to be for spatial detail work.
Yes, you can actually form with these if need be, just like you would with soft clay, but it's for quite fine work. Then there.
Excuse me. Is that a special kind of wood?
Yes, this one is ebony,
mm-hmm.
and it's very hard. Polishes nice,
mm-hmm.
and I have a sort of a knife edge at one end, straight edge, and it comes to a point. And it's very handy because you can use it as a knife if you need to for certain things, mm-hmm. minor things, even aluminum foil. The other end is sort of a spatula, round end.
Mm-hmm.
But this tool has been copied by many, many people.
Has it?
The original one of that came from Lewis Artist Supply. Lewis Artist Supply is one of the companies that has provided tools for the industry, modeling industry here in Detroit. As
LEWIS.
Well as
LEWIS. Are they a local firm?
They're down on Woodward Avenue. Very near GM's Art and Color, where it used to be, in the old GM building.
May well have been a reason for them to establish this.
It's quite possible. They have all sorts of artist supplies and modeler supplies. More recent years, DMI, which has a few stores in this area, this vicinity, has supplied both artists and modelers. There's another company on the east side of town that supplies tools especially for the automotive engineer, but many of these tools, of course, are used by the modelers. The straight edges and sweeps and curves are supplied by this company. Let me see if I can find them in my list here. Anyway, various companies were contacted and really developed by us at Ford to do the construction of much of the equipment that we design in the modeling systems area.
The specifications and that.
We gave them we developed it and gave them the drawings and they built it. However, we did not have patents on these designs, and we did not require that they should not copy these and sell them to others, and that's basically what has happened throughout the industry here.
Is that deliberate on your part, or just a slip of the...
I would say it was more or less deliberate. My interest has been in developing the process,
right,
and helping the people in the industry. And it helped Ford first, but we'll get into this later. The problems that modelers had were tremendous because nobody understood their needs, nobody cared for their needs,
mm-hmm.
and as a result, they worked under very very poor conditions, just not acceptable, absolutely not acceptable. And
substandard tools, and
as I had mentioned earlier, when I came back from Germany, nothing really had progressed other than they were doing all of their developments full size, and they had the same tools that they had when I left, which of course when I left, the new bridges in the main studios were fairly new, and they were fairly good, but they had these other bridges, but they had no means of having accurate models. The models themselves were very poor. The armatures, the fixtures that they used were, fixtures were almost non-existent. Armatures were very poor. As a result, why it took tremendous hours to build and maintain a model.
Even that recently?
Yes.
Which was what,
68 is when I, 67 is when I came back from Germany and started on this. So it really started in 68. If I can find this card. Oh, I've got it here. Yeah, true. The company that builds or supplies sweeps and straight edges and all the equipment that engineers require and modelers, many of the tools that modelers require, is called Dual Instrument Service. Capital D-U dash capital A-L-L, Instrument Service. And they're on 8 Mile, East 8 Mile Road here in Detroit. There's another company which has evolved through a few hands, but it's been called Industrial Clay Tool Company. And this is presently run by a fellow who came from Austria, and quite an interesting story. He emigrated first to Germany, I believe, and West Germany, and then to Canada. And he was working for Ford of Canada and got engine division, I believe, and he got transferred to Cleveland. He wanted to come to the United States. And while he was at Cleveland, he made, and you may be aware of this, he made a scale model of a Ford V8 engine and gave it to the current Ford president, who was it Kutcher?
Was it Andy Kutcher was the vice president for research?
No. Who was the president like?
Napoleon?
Who? No.
Oh, at that time?
Way back, yeah, like...
What year?
Well, it must have been like
1965. Would that be R.J. Miller?
No. Well...
Dijkstra?
Might have been Dijkstra.
Yeah, he was a manufacturing man. Yeah.
Yes, right. He was a manufacturing man.
Right.
He gave this engine model, and all the parts worked. It was all there. To, I think it was Dijkstra. And it was quite amazing, you know, and it was on display in the glass house for some time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Dijkstra called Bordenay and said, we've got a fellow here that made this engine model. He's over in Cleveland. I think it's somebody that you should have over there in design. So that's how he got into design.
What was his name again?
His name is Herbert Gashler, G-A-S-C-H-L-E-R. And later on, the fellows that were making these tools, which had were retirees from the metal shop at Ford Design, no longer wanted to be in the business anymore, so he acquired the business, and he has made quite a big thing of it. And he sells tools to everybody throughout the world, everybody that's building clay models. So he's made, he still works in design.
At Ford.
Mm-hmm.
He does this as a
excellent
side line?
He does this as a side. His wife takes care of the business. He does some of the things himself and a lot of the things he has made. But he makes these sorts of tools. The larger tools consist of larger, what they call scrapers. They may be tooth, they may not be, but they come in various sizes. This is like a 4-inch tooth scraper, it's tooth on one side.
Mm-hmm.
It's similar to the smaller scraper in that it's flat on the inside, V'd on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And
what would be the advantage of a tooth surface?
Well, it tends to ride easier.
Mm.
It's hard to draw a flat blade across the clay and get a good, a smooth cut.
Mm-hmm.
It tends to want to jump.
Mm-hmm.
And
the indentations may give it a smoother track.
Yes.
I see.
That type of scraper comes in various sizes. I've got one here that's like a 3-inch and a smaller blade. One with a slight bow in it, the smaller yet. One that is a big loop. And you'd use this type of thing for removing a large amount of clay if you wanted to get the surface cut down. Then you have other tools. After you've used those tools, the so-called scrapers, you'd probably go to a wood battant, and that's nothing more than a piece of flat wood. This particular one is 1 inch by 18 by 1/8.
Almost like a straight edge ruler.
It's like a straight edge ruler. It's made out of maple. It's very straight, and to get a good one, you have to make about 3.
Really?
Well, you know, they warp, and
I see.
So you buy these by you'll buy a big stack of them, and then you sort of pick through them. But these will come in various sizes. They'll go up to like 3/16 by 30 inches by inch and a half, 2 inches. They go on up to like a quarter by 3 feet and 2 inches, and maybe then on up to 5/16 to 3/8 by 3 inches or so, something like that. 3 inches by 4 feet.
Mm-hmm.
And with these, you can cover a very large area and get a very good surface without holes. This is basically what you're doing. You're looking for holes with these tools, which you can't really see and control with the scraper. So you take the batten or the surface, and you use the size of batten depending upon the surface form. If the surface is very flat, you can use a big, heavy wood batten. If your surface has a lot of form, why you have to use something smaller and something with more flex to it.
So this would be a two-handed downward.
That's correct. Requires two hands.
Out scraping motion.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
The next tool that you use, and this was demonstrated in that slide presentation, and perhaps if we go through that again here sometime, you recognize some of these things.
Yes. Mm, I like
the
that.
Next step would be to use what they call steels, and these are blue steel scrapers. And they do the same thing as the wood batten, except they leave a very smooth surface. And they come in various sizes and, indeed, various shapes.
Mm-hmm.
and various thicknesses, right,
for large areas,
down to very thin, and
a basic tool, obviously.
Very basic.
In the initial preparation.
That's right. Yeah. And this is really what you finish the modeling with. And when the model is finished, the clay surface is finished, then you'll go over it with a plastic slick. This is a type of plastic slick. It has a very smooth edge, and that will lay down all of the surface that the steel has left, so it puts it into a very smooth, highly smooth surface. Since the clay has so much wax in it, it then will shine if you go over it with a cloth with water. And so those are basically the tools used by the modeler.
Fascinating.
Well, anyway, let's revert back now to 1946.
Good. Really the beginning of the modern clay modeler. It would seem then that 1946 is pretty much the beginning of the modern clay modeling techniques in the automobile industry, would you say?
Yes, in fact, I want to go back before the war again. I'd like to go back again to 1942. Okay. Yes, that's true. Following the war is when design really blossomed. Before the war, this work was being done, but it was really in a developmental stage. In 19, of course, clay had been used particularly by everybody doing full-size models. The last half of the 1930s, and certainly the vehicles that came out in the early 40s. GM, of course, in those days, and even after the war, Fisher Body played a great part of their developments. The divisions at General Motors, I guess they called it Art and Color Studios. The divisions had studios, and they did basically the front end sheet metal and fenders and all the ornamentation, and I suppose they did one body development, but it was developed closely with Fisher Body, and Fisher Body finalized all of the bodies. I'm not sure whether they may have also finalized the front end sheet metal, which was different on every vehicle. Bodies were generally the same throughout, although the fenders and some areas were somewhat different. And of course, all the ornamentation was different. So the responsibilities were somewhat split there between the General Motors Art and Color and Fisher Body. Ford, of course, during those years, starting with the I think you had mentioned the 37 grill, the 38s, I think entirely were done by the new Ford design department. And of course, thereafter, the bridges were designed and developed and used on those 38 vehicles and the 40s. When I was there in 41, during that period of time, of course the war had started in Germany, or in Poland, and America, we were not in the war yet, but of course our war effort was increasing. And when I started there, there was maybe 45, 47 people total. But and this was in April of 41. But as time passed, why, people were leaving Forest Service, so that by the time war actually started, on we were into the war by December 8th, there were perhaps only, I suppose it was cut down to half. There was maybe 20, 25 people by that time. And I can remember on that Monday, Franklin Delano Roosevelt speaking to Congress, and of course this was on the radio, and they had a production vehicle in the studio, and they had the radio on. We all gathered around it and listened to his speech. So anyway, beyond that point, of course, people continued to leave. So I was the last one in, hired in, and I wasn't, by that time I was 20 years old, and I wasn't real young, you know, but 20 is still a pretty young age. But I had the advantage of working with all of the senior people that were there, and they were still there. They haven't left. So that's how I happened to be working on this model with Bill Wagner and various other ones there doing special developments that they wanted done. So to me, it was a great learning experience during that period.
Yes.
Well, I was there until I believe it was February of 1942. And by that time, it had dwindled down to like 14 people. And so I was transferred out, transferred over to engineering in the airframe building. And they had flown in a B-24 Liberator bomber from Consolidated Vultee into the old Ford airfield, and had disassembled it, and were in the process of redesigning certain areas and preparing it for mass production out at Willow Run. So I was transferred into a group that was called Parts List Division, and the bomber was broken down into approximately 70 what they called items, each item being a major assembly. Final assembly was item 70, but it instead of being a major assembly in itself, of course, it was the final putting together of all of the various parts that have to go together to make it. But I had three items. I had what was called the pilot's floor and the navigator's floor and the bulkhead that went between. So, of course, these were the initial structural pieces that were manufactured and assembled together into a unit. But anyway, we were getting drawings from engineering. And these drawings, the interesting part of this story is that these drawings were copies of Consolidated Vultee's drawings. Of course, Consolidated Vultee built several airplanes, and some of these airplanes use some of the same parts. So that Ford would copy the drawings, every drawing that came in, and it was supposed to be in a certain item, the pilot's floor, let's say. Well, maybe it was and maybe it wasn't. Because the Ford bomber, to begin with, was somewhat different, and also, it was used in so many items, and maybe the drawing wasn't correct in its designation. So, sometime in May, we moved out to Willow Run, and this was before what is known as I-94 was completed, Ford Expressway, which becomes I-94. So...
what year was this?
This was 42. May of 42. And they weren't finished building Willow Run either. They were still constructing the end of the building. They were stamping parts up in the front end of the building. At the other building, they were still building the plant. And interesting to me was that no more had we gotten there than they started to move some of these things outside, which, you know, this is the way manufacturing works. They get other suppliers, sub-suppliers to build things, so they would move out equipment and machines and move other things in. But it was quite a operation to see that building, the fixtures and so forth, the machines come in there and to build this bomber. Well, in the summer, by the way, some of the people from design were there also, besides me.
Remember any
Bill,
names?
Well, Bill Wagner, Willis B. Wagner,
right,
was a checker in engineering. So he was always nearby and always go chat with him, you know.
Very helpful.
And, but about this time, they decided that the drawings and the parts list that we were making, they were buying parts from the engineering drawings. And so every consolidated Balti drawing that came in, Ford would copy, and parts were ordered, either built there or dies and whatever built on the outside to purchase the parts. They found that many of these parts weren't needed. And so they had a department down to Rouge that had supplied a service similar to what we were doing. And it was called the Production Department. And this was under Dick Bullock, who was one of Bricker's right-hand men.
Lee Bricker, who was pretty much the chief of Worldwide Production, was he?
Yeah, I think he became that. That's
later
correct.
On, yeah.
Later on, yeah.
How do you spell Bullock?
B-U-L-L-I-C-K, Dick Bullock. And he was a little man and somewhat older. And he had a man under him by the name of Dick Farley, who was, I suppose, at that time in his 50s, and sort of wiry red hair and a real go-getter. He was, again, one of the people I learned from, you know, both of these people. Bullock was a man of very few words, really old-time Ford exact. Farley had many words, and he was a younger man and a graduate from maybe Harvard, I'm not sure, but quite brilliant fellow. Well, they came in and took over this parts list division. Of course, this was, for me, I had felt that I would have been better off on the board, you know, at that time. But I'm glad I stayed with this, because they set up a planning and scheduling department and took over all of planning, the release of drawings, took over control of the all the parts cribs and many areas, all the paperwork. We were moved over into the administration building. There wasn't anything in that building at that time.
Over at Schaefer Road?
No, at Willow Run.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, of course. Yes.
And took over several offices, and they brought in some of their own people, and really knew, you know, they knew how they had been handling the automobile, and so they knew what to look for in this. So basically what we did from that point forward, we would go to the shop area where the items were being built and make our parts list up from what was actually going in. And no matter what drawing might be released by the engineering organization, why, we would only put into our parts list what was actually going into the plane as it was being constructed, and purchased according to our parts list. What made this an ongoing operation was the fact that many changes came through, and they call them master changes. And I think the first one was like on airplane 8 and 11, I remember that, and like 18 and maybe 25, and then it got up to maybe 38 and 50, and then 100, and maybe 250, because production was increasing, you know.
Mm-hmm. You did have a long startup time, as I recall.
Yes, and
what were the reasons for that?
Well, it was a tremendous effort.
Yeah, right.
And nobody understood this.
Mm-hmm.
And the fellow that they had put in charge, and I'm trying to remember his name, it doesn't want to come right now, of Willow Run, became the scapegoat for the fact that it didn't go, and of course it wasn't his fault. There were lots of problems, just like this one I mentioned.
Yeah.
The drawings that were received from Consolidated Baltee didn't necessarily mean that it was going into the Ford plane, and even if it did, it probably had changes.
You did say that they were redesigning the
They redesigned many areas. For instance, Consolidated Baltee were built as, well, I've got another slide presentation that I want to show you, and it talks about, during that period of time, building planes on one at a time, one at a kind. So, Consolidated Baltee had maybe only built three of them.
Mm.
And one of those flew into Ford and was torn down. For instance, the pilot's enclosure consisted of maybe 100 pieces. It had the various plastic window pieces, and these were held in by small stampings. Well, Ford made, they didn't make one inner and one outer, but they made like, maybe three outers and three inners out of 100. They had a half dozen. And they did the same thing with the bombardier's enclosure and, throughout the plane.
Mm-hmm.
They just designed it for high production. The air surfaces, of course, didn't change, but they updated some of the various mechanicals. One of the first changes that went in, one of the first major changes, all the controls, or many of the controls, were operated by hydraulics. And of course, hydraulics are very susceptible to bullets, and they always leak, and they're always a problem.
It's susceptible to very low temperatures as well.
Low temperatures. So one of the first major changes was changing the controls over to electric control from hydraulic.
Mm.
So all of these servos went in, which meant that they had to have brackets to mount the servos, and of course they had tremendous wiring harnesses, which they didn't have before. And so it just doing that one was quite a major task. And then they would make a series of planes, let's say, for the Pacific, and then they'd make a series for maybe for Europe, and maybe for the Aleutians, and they would be somewhat different.
Mm.
And
do you remember the whether you made many privateers at Willow Run? Those were the high straight tail for the Navy.
Yeah, no. What they did do, one of the final changes during the evolution of changes on that plane was to go to a single tail rather than the double. And this was to come out like in something number 6,800, I don't remember for sure, but something like that. And they had built one and had tested it by the time war was over, but they never got into production. I'm sure they had much of the tooling ready, and they may have had parts, but they never got it into production. And along with that, they had made many other, they had really modernized the plane, but they I guess it was built by, probably by Consolidated. You want a drink of water?
No, fine.
Well, about during the latter part of 42 or early 43, the Truman Committee had been established, and Truman was
this
going
was a
around.
Senate subcommittee to investigate the war effort.
Yes, Senate subcommittee, and Truman was a senator and in charge of this committee. And they wanted to know why Ford wasn't building these planes like they had said they were going to. So he came there and went through the plant. And
was that in 42?
It was either the end of 42 or early 43, and I'm not sure which. It could have been the end of 42.
You're still having startup problems.
They were having startup problems. And it must have been in the end of 42. Along with him, or during that period of time, Knudsen came. Of course, he was a general at that time. He was put in charge
of all war production.
Of all war efforts.
Sort of a high-level expediter.
Yes. And
this is William Knudsen.
William
General
Knudsen,
Motors,
yes, senior. He was really a tremendous sight to see. He was tall. He had on this general's uniform, straight and tall and neat as a pin, you know.
He was a lieutenant general, as I recall.
I believe so.
Yeah. Three-star. Yeah.
So he came, I suppose, along at the time that Truman came. And I remember seeing him get off the elevator, you know, and they had their meetings there. And I still haven't remembered the man responsible for Willamette at that time. But anyway, of course, he was pulled out. And I guess that's when Bricker was put in.
He was brought in from the Ypsilanti plant, as I recall. What was his name again?
Yeah, I'll have to think some more about
it.
Yeah,
I'll just have it to my
tongue. Which, of course, is quite a blow to him, and it wasn't due to his problems. But they discussed the problems and concluded that they should do certain things and stress certain things, which, you know, they did make some changes at that point. And, of course, they learned of some of the problems involved. Well, it wasn't, I suppose, let's say 6 months after that, they started coming off the line. And it must have been sometime in the summer of 43 that, and I can't remember for sure the date, but when Roosevelt visited, I think we talked about that.
Yes, right.
And since we were in the administration building, it was out in front of the plant, and that's where the railroad switch came in. And one day, we see a passenger train back up, and some men get off and look around and get back on, and the train pulled out and went away. Well, the next day, Roosevelt came in, and so apparently that was Secret Service agents. And the last time I saw Edsel was the day that Roosevelt came through, and Edsel pulled up out in front of the administration building, and he was driving a Continental, and he jumped out. The roof was down, as I recall. It must have been summer, and he ran into the building. And we watched Roosevelt go through, you know, and it was sort of a special time, because by that time, of course, things were moving off the line. So anyway,
as I recall from that visit, he had an especial interest in the little people, or midgets, they were using.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember
that? Yes, that's right. They had some midgets that they would send into areas of the plane, like into the wing and so forth, where they had to route harnesses and things nobody else could get into. That's true.
And Mr. Roosevelt took a special interest in them, and Harry Bennett asked one of them to come forward and speak to Mr. Roosevelt.
Ah, yes.
Tell him what he was doing.
Uh-huh. Well, they drove a special car down through the building there out to
the Sunshine Special, I think it was.
I think it was. Yeah, yeah, I think they brought
it in.
It's
in the museum today.
Yeah, they must have brought it in on the train. Well, production, well, eventually, well, let's go step by step here. Eventually, purchasing, which had been down to Rouge, and we had very close contact in our so-called production department with purchasing, because they were buying from our parts list. Eventually, purchasing moved out and moved into the administration building, and we moved out of the administration building over to one of the lofts where they handled the all of the release work. And summer of 40, or the fall of 43, I was to be drafted, and I had kept my draft board at Findlay and Ohio. So I went down there, and I had made arrangements with my fiance. We were going to get married. So I was going to have my physical on a Thursday, and we were going to get married on a Saturday, and then have a short honeymoon, I suppose, and I'd be inducted. I didn't leave Ford. I figured, well, I'll come back and sure. Close things up. Yeah. So I went down, and we were bussed up to Toledo. And I'll turn it off. I'm going to have to get Sue here. Yeah, Roscoe Smith. When he was let out.
He was the initial head of.
He was the initial head of the operation at Willow Run. He generally wasn't too well liked. I'm sure he had a lot of problems and pressures, but perhaps this may have been part of the problem. He didn't seem to be able to easily control these situations, and he had rather a sour disposition. And Bricker was a...
This is Mead Bricker.
Mead Bricker was a big, rough, tough-looking guy, one that appeared to be able to handle any situation.
The old Bull of the Woods type.
Old Bull of the Woods. Bullock was worked directly for Bricker, had it at Rouge, and he worked for him, under him, at Willow Run, and continued his responsibilities also at Rouge. But anyway, he was a rather small man, and somewhat older. I suppose he was in his lighter 50s, maybe. In his 50s, anyway. And he didn't say much, very quiet, very small. He didn't look like a person of a great position, but he really held great control over all of these areas that they had took over at Willow Run, and he had a great understanding of everything that went on. And under him, the fellow that I worked for was this fellow Dick Farley, which is this fellow on the right, or on on your left.
The lively red-headed gentleman.
Yeah, this guy here. And he really organized all of the operations which I had mentioned there at Willow Run. The cribs, all of the paperwork, all of the release efforts. He got things working with purchasing, and well, he just made things function. He put in the IBM system, by the way, at that time.
What type of system was it?
Which is similar to computer printout sheets, putting everything
right
in a certain order. And they had special typewriters. They had girls that they would send away and take a course to do this work.
Mm-hmm.
So they had it advanced. It was an advancement at that time, like computer is today, mm-hmm. to other types of things. So
it was a systems analysis. or to the listings of tools, or?
Well, listings of anything, particularly right? The parts, the
parts
Cribs control, which was a big problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do they need, when do they need it, and how many do they need, and when do you have to order them, and...
It'd really be a systems control, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I suppose you could call it a systems control.
Then in its infancy, probably came to the fore during, because the needs of World War II production.
Yes, I presume so. Yeah. Okay. I went to take my physical, and for some reason I was called out, and instead of going back to Findlay, I was sent to Camp Perry along Lake Erie, and I called up my fiance and said, I'm in Camp Perry, and I don't have toothbrush or pajamas or anything. So they came up on a Sunday, she and my parents and also an aunt and uncle of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I don't know why I'm here. They haven't said. Well, anyway, I guess it was on a Monday or Tuesday. It must have been on a Monday. I had another x-ray, and they found that I had two spots on my lung. One about the size of a half dollar, one about the size of a quarter. And there was no way to tell whether they were active or inactive. So I was not inducted at that time. I was told that I should see my family doctor, which I did. And he took another x-ray and found the same thing of course. And he said, well, you just have to be careful and do certain things and don't do certain other things. And you can only tell by time. So, our workload seemed to increase, and in 1944, we did get married on the 26th of June, but up until the 26th of June, I only had 2 days off. And we worked 10 hours a day, except for Saturdays and Sundays, where you worked 8 hours. But, so we got married, and